coming up on this special edition of The Green from Delaware Public Media. Election Day is now just 1 week away, and we take a look at some more key races in the first state where incumbents face strong challenges this year. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We'll examine the races for House District 21 and Senate District 5 in the General Assembly, seats Democrats hope to flip from red to blue. Plus, we have the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities A Matter of Fact podcast, focusing on Twitter. It's all next on this special edition of The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this special edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Election Day is now just 1 week away, and we have a few more races to watch that we want to highlight as we near the end of this 2020 election cycle. We head to the General Assembly, where there's another state Senate seat in Newcastle County that Democrats see an opportunity to flip, a seat that an incumbent Republican has held for more than two decades. Delaware Public Media contributor Mark Fowler takes us to the state Senate's 5th District, which covers a wide area between I-95, Concord Pike, and up to the Pennsylvania line.
For 20 years, the district has been represented by State Senator Kathy Cloutier, who has also served as Senate Minority Whip since 2018. Previously, she was a state representative for 2 years after the death of her husband, Representative Phil Cloutier. Kathy Cloutier declined to be interviewed for this story. In a recent Newcastle County League of Women Voters candidates forum, she stated, "Our life experiences make us who we are." She added that she is a mother of three adopted children, a wife and a widow, a caregiver, community volunteer, and a proud senator.
"I love serving Brandywine 100 and the people who live in this community. I am running again because during these challenging times, I know there's so much more to do and I want to keep helping."
The Democratic candidate is Kyle Evans-Gay, also a mother. She's an attorney and a founding member of Spur Impact Association, which encourages young professionals to become civically engaged. Gay began her candidacy during the summer of 2019, but said she had been thinking about running a year before after being disappointed and frustrated at some of Cloutier's votes and the incumbent's approach to leadership in Dover.
"And I think that my story is just a reflection of so many people in Delaware and in America who say enough is enough. It's time for a real change, and we're willing to make the sacrifice and do the hard work in order to get that there for our community."
Gay was the winner of a three-way Democratic primary in September. She has accused Cloutier of blocking legislation that would have banned what many call assault weapons. But Cloutier, on her campaign website, said Gay is misrepresenting the truth, that she did not block the legislation. She could not be present for a June 2018 vote due to illness. And in 2019, the Senate President Pro Tem David McBride withheld a bill from a floor vote. There might have been a vote in 2020 if not for COVID. Cloutier stated on her website that she wants clear and effective legislation that bans several dangerous assault weapons and hopes a, quote, better version of the bill is created and debated on the Senate floor. Cloutier has voted in favor of a ban on bump stocks and for increased penalties for straw purchases of firearms. Gay is in the race for other reasons as well.
"We are behind in health care and making sure that every Delawarean who needs health care has it. And we know that with COVID, we have seen the effects of the lack of health care for certain communities, for certain individuals. The time is clearly now to fix that problem."
The pandemic is likely to remain the prime focus of legislators as they begin a new Delaware General Assembly in January. Cloutier, during the League of Women Voters Forum, said with no playbook, Governor John Carney was doing the best he could. She has been inspired by arts venues, schools, and businesses rallying to find solutions as they try to reopen safely. In the League of Women Voters Forum, Cloutier explained her approach should COVID-related matters be debated in the General Assembly.
"And it is about the schools and the teachers, also businesses opening, protecting most vulnerable citizens, and protecting access to health care and equality for all."
Cloutier stated on her campaign website that she actually shifted efforts of her supporters to respond to the unfolding challenges related to the pandemic. They recruited more than 100 Meals on Wheels volunteers, acquired and distributed more than 4,000 masks for frontline workers, supported the food bank, and delivered meals to first responders and nurses. By and large, Cloutier said she suspended most fundraisers and many campaign phone calls while distributing mainly COVID-19 informational emails. When lawmakers return, they will be facing what's likely to be a challenging budget year. Although recent revenue projections were somewhat encouraging, the economy is still very much struggling. Gay has proposed investments into universal pre-K and more support of education.
What you really have to think about is how are we prioritizing? And when we send more Democrats and more like-minded legislators down to Dover, we know that we have a seat at the table as far as those priorities. And when we think about education specifically, our job as we deal with, yes, the changes in revenue due to COVID and the challenges that we're going to be facing is making sure that we're standing a line that our children are not going to suffer because of it and that education is the last thing that gets cut.
There's also the matter, Gay said, of serving a constituency in a district that has some long-established neighborhoods with infrastructure challenges.
We also have antiquated wastewater management systems and, you know, talk to any homeowner, including myself, in Brandywine 100, and they'll tell you about water in their basement. What we need to make sure we do is understand how we can modernize some of our systems, how we can make sure that we are helping homeowners protect their property values, and making sure that we are listening to the community as to what they really need day to day.
Gay has taken issue with Cloutier, as she puts it, giving away funds to Republicans in other districts meant for road improvements in Brandywine 100. Cloutier stated on her website that it was money she returned that was borrowed to bring about improvements a year earlier. While COVID is a major focus of concern, Delaware's Division of Public Health reports nearly 300 suspected overdose-related deaths in 2020. Cloutier stated during the League of Women Voters Forum, behavioral health remains a challenging problem.
This issue is one which is often forgotten when we talk about health care. We need more mental health care in schools, in prisons, and all through our community. We also need to understand that drug addiction is also a mental health crisis.
The 5th District is seen by Democratic Party leaders as one that is flippable. Although represented by a Republican for years, it actually has several thousand more registered Democrats than Republicans. During this campaign, Gay participated in Black Lives Matter demonstrations and stood with the Delaware Legislative Black Caucus as they outlined measures designed to bring about more police accountability. She does not shy away from being known for progressive values.
I am running on the values that I believe represent my district. I believe I am the best representative of my district in the race. I do believe in progressive values. I believe in supporting and increasing the minimum wage. I believe that everyone, you know, we should be supporting working families. And I believe we should be doing more to provide health care and other services to our neighbors.
As she made her closing arguments to voters, Kyle Evans-Gay said she believes she is what the district's voters are looking for in a legislator.
And I think really what we need in this new unprecedented time are folks who are willing to put in that hard work, folks who are willing to build coalitions, and folks who, like me, are anxious to see change and to put in the hard work to get it done.
Kathy Cloutier, speaking during the League of Women Voters Forum, cited her sponsorship of Smart 911, which allows first responders to enter a home to rescue a person if doors are locked and the person is not able to communicate, as an example of legislation that she has backed that truly helped Delawareans.
This is why I'm running, to help people I care about, and why I'm asking for your vote, to keep making a difference in Brandywine 100.
Both campaigns have robustly fundraised in an attempt to win District 5. In the Senate, Democrats currently hold a 12-9 advantage over Republicans and see flipping this seat as a way to solidify their majority hold on that chamber. Mark Fauser, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Mark. And we'll continue our look at races to watch in a moment, moving to the State House, where another Republican is fighting to keep a seat red in a rematch. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. We wrap up our Races to Watch series with a state house race that's a rematch of a 2018 contest. Delaware Public Media's Nick Schellino has more on Republican Mike Ramone's effort to repeat his narrow victory over Democrat Stephanie Barry.
Delaware's 21st House District in northern Newcastle County includes parts of Pike Creek and Pike Creek Valley. Michael Ramone is seeking a seventh term. After defeating Democrat Patricia Creedon in 2008, he ran unopposed up until 2014 when he handily defeated Green Party candidate David McCorquodale and did the same again in 2016, each time by a more than 60-point margin. But when Democrat Stephanie Barry challenged him in 2018, Ramone won by just 409 votes in a race with more than 9,800 voters. Barry says she's encouraged by that result because she had only started campaigning 4 months leading up to the election.
This year, it made me realize that there was a tremendous amount of support. I just needed to start earlier, talk to more people, and that's what we did.
Since the last election, Barry has also been active in combating a proposed development at Three Little Bakers Golf Course. An out-of-state developer has been battling deed restrictions on the property and is still in litigation.
We managed to get over 300 people attending a county council meeting to stand up and talk about why the deed restrictions needed to be enforced. And it was significant reasons, environmental impact as well as impact on local infrastructure, water issues, school, you know, all of that.
Ramone chairs the Small Business Caucus, and he has a history of working with Democrats. He cites former House Speaker Bob Gillion as a mentor and worked with former State Representative Melanie George Smith on the Joint Finance Committee and later with retiring State Representative Quinn Johnson on budget-smoothing legislation. The effort ultimately did not pass, but acted as the framework for an executive order from Governor John Carney, which, as Ramone points out, later came in handy with the deficit caused by COVID-19.
We could balance our budget because of the budget-smoothing fund without having to lower people's pay or cut jobs or downsize the government or, raise taxes.
At the start of the COVID outbreak, Ramone says he put together daily reports and held weekly Zoom meetings for his constituents and says he's proud the 21st has no COVID deaths. He was also vocal early on in offering a mission statement for COVID response to Carney, emphasizing management of at-risk communities. The plan was ultimately not adopted. Ramone is also critical of the state's decision to allow larger box stores to remain open while small businesses were forced to shut down.
You can't pick winners and losers because the spread moves to those areas, and that's what we saw, unfortunately. We did good. We did better than many, but I think we could have done better, and I really think we failed on our long-term care facilities. We didn't get them the supplies, the attention, and the support they needed when some of us were trying to do that earlier.
Barry praises Delaware's response to COVID, applauding the state's efforts to make testing widely available and Carney's approach to reopening the economy.
Trying to balance the needs of the economy as well as the safety of everyone. I certainly know that school reopening is at the tops of everybody's mind right now, and I have confidence that they will come to good resolutions to balance the two.
Barry's top issue is health care. She says if she is elected, she will work to bring down the state's cost of care, which is among the most expensive per person in the nation. She also supports a bill in the General Assembly to expand mental health services in schools. That measure has yet to receive a vote.
When I talk to people in the district, health care costs is really number one. And that's something that I think needs to really be brought to light in the General Assembly.
Barry also supports implementing a permanent vote-by-mail option, and she wants to raise the minimum wage, which Ramone has consistently voted against and even sponsored 2018 legislation allowing employers to pay minors and adults in their first 90 days of work 50 cents less an hour than the minimum wage.
The reason I'm running is I do not believe that his voting record represents the needs and the values of the district. So I am giving the voters in the district the opportunity to elect somebody who better represents those values.
Ramone, meanwhile, says he does not see the legislature addressing any issues that are not related to the pandemic for some time if Delaware remains in a state of emergency.
If that continues to be extended, you know, we don't go in session. I'm not really sure what it looks like. I don't know that anybody's overly optimistic on getting a lot of good, healthy bills passed this year, just like we weren't able to get a lot of good, healthy bills passed last year.
He adds he's critical of both parties and concerned the current political climate nationally is adding to the problem.
I would have liked to seen, you know, someone show the leadership and the guidance and the stamina to not, you know, roll in the mud with people. And unfortunately, politics has digressed to a point where, you know, you get a lot more votes out of hatred than you do out of love.
Democrats continue to hold a registration edge in the district with 31 more registered voters than Republicans. But the district has a little more than 5,000 registered voters not affiliated with either of the two major parties. Those are voters Ramon needs to turn out for him if he wants to hang on to the seat. Nick Schellino, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Nick. And stay with us. We finish up this special edition of The Green with the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A Matter of Facts. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, we bring you the latest installment of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A Matter of Facts. The podcast delves into identifying trustworthy and reliable sources of news and information as part of Delaware Humanities' mission to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. This season, the podcast more closely examines popular sources of news and information. This episode focuses on Twitter. A 2019 Pew Research Center study found that 22% of U.S. adults use Twitter. It also found the 10% of users who are most active there are responsible for 80% of all tweets created. Of course, one of those highly active users is President Trump, who has made Twitter a primary source of communicating his message since being elected 4 years ago. That has created some controversy, as has the platform's efforts to get a grip on how it handles content that could be considered misinformation or hate speech, and the users who create that content. To help us better understand Twitter and how it operates, the podcast talked to Deb Roy. The professor of media arts and sciences at MIT is director of the Lab for Social Machines and executive director of MIT's Media Lab. And from 2013 to 2017, he served as Twitter's chief media scientist. Here is the latest episode of A Matter of Facts. Before we dig into some more specific questions, I want to kind of start with a more broader question, and that is, are we looking at another kind of crossroads moment for Twitter and some of these other platforms? We have a heated election, a polarized nation, countries also dealing with a pandemic and issues of racial justice. Will how platforms like Twitter are navigating this situation, this time, have a potentially long-lasting impact and repercussions for them?
I definitely think it's an important moment for the social media platforms. You know, in 2016, if there was anyone left who was active on the internet who hadn't stopped to think about the role that social media plays, you know, in their lives personally and for us as a democracy, I think we all had a moment to stop and reflect. And at this point, as we go into the most unusual election, I think, of all of our lifetimes, realizing that social media is just woven into our lives and the just collective attention on the platforms and the attention that now through the media and so on that is on the platforms. Yeah, I think this is a singular moment. It probably has felt like that for several years now if you were you know, operating one of these platforms, but it feels more heightened than ever. So, yeah, I think this is a new chapter opening up for them.
Having said that, let's go back a little bit first. And as we look at Twitter, how far has it come from what it was when it emerged on the scene in 2006? How different is it from what was kind of initially imagined for Twitter?
Yeah, that's a great question. That, you know, of course, I wasn't there when it began. I joined myself, I think, around 2011. And, you know, from the beginning, I think that Twitter had at least two different ideas for what it was for. You know, when you talk to people at Twitter and as they were building it, that it's a way to let the world know what's on your mind and what you're doing. And it's also a way to find out what's happening in the world. And sort of those two, you know, very personal, you know, me as an individual broadcasting my thoughts, or being able to tune in to people and topics that I care about, really has been sort of the two uses or the two reasons to be on Twitter from the beginning. Which one's more important and why are people going to it? It maybe has ebbed and flowed. But, you know, and just that simplicity originally of, you know, 140 characters and a hit send and off it goes to whoever cares to follow you in this sort of transparent and open world. It was a simple, lightweight, you know, way to share your thoughts and tune into others. In some ways, the experience on Twitter is remarkably similar to those early days. But when you have hundreds of millions of people using them, including sitting politicians and you know, journalists and others who rely on it as a kind of central information service, of course, its meaning and the weight of what it means to operate Twitter or to be on Twitter has changed completely. So in some ways, it's surprisingly similar to the original. In other ways, its meaning and importance has is maybe unrecognizable from the early days of finding out what someone had for breakfast as being one of the main things you could learn on Twitter.
At this juncture, do we have a sense of what Twitter users in general look like? You know, who's using it and how much?
Well, I think that I'm just looking up here. According to Google, or you know, when we look at the current sort of stats, about 48 million people in the U.S. Are on Twitter. So that means, of course, more people in the U.S. are not on Twitter than are. But it's a pretty large sample. I think there is, you know, some groups. If you're over the age of 65, last I checked, you might be underrepresented. You know, in that. If you treat that as a sample of the population, there's some groups that are overrepresented. But, you know, so tens of millions of people on the platform. And I don't know how to characterize beyond that. I know just personally, I have a lot of friends who are in the media industry and journalists and so forth, and it seems pretty much mandatory to be on Twitter if you're right. In certain professions, right? And then if you're a news junkie, if you're a political junkie, it's probably hard to stay away. But there's a lot of people who are on there purely for entertainment, or they're just following, you know, area. So they're into cooking and right. And food, and that's what they use Twitter for. So there really is everything under the sun that you can find there.
And it's funny because you've talked a little bit about, you know, particularly the initial attempt was kind of give people an opportunity to kind of give their thoughts. And also, as we're talking, we talk about it being a place where you can get information, whether it be, you know, if you're a news junkie or someone who's interested in cooking or something like that. And I guess I want to delve a little bit into kind of that dual role, because some of your research, you know, has examined how Twitter can be used to measure public opinion, the kind of, you know, people broadcasting their thoughts piece of it. And I found this fascinating, mm-hmm. since one of the things we hear a lot of times from critics of Twitter is, well, Twitter isn't real life. Suggesting it doesn't really reflect the world as it is, or maybe all of the world, or enough of the world to be useful in understanding, you know, what public opinion is. Can you tell us a little bit about your research and what it found about it as a public opinion kind of source?
Sure. Yeah. I think I've never really understood when people have brought that point up, because I think it's clear that, you know, there are lots of real human beings on Twitter, often sharing what they think about different things. Of course, when you are sharing your opinions or sharing your thoughts, and, you know, also just sharing, like sharing something you saw that you think others should see, it is a kind of, it's like a performance. You know that other people are going to see what you're saying, and so you might say certain things if a pollster calls you up and you're having a confidential, you know, conversation, or you're filling in a survey, versus tweeting into sort of the public airwaves, so to speak, that you're going to say different things, right, in different contexts. But I don't know how it's any less true of an indication of what someone's on someone's mind. Yeah, there's certain things you'll say in one context and not another, but I think it's a reasonable listening channel for what's on people's minds. So, you know, in our research, I'll give you a couple of examples. One is during the 2016 presidential election, we were interested in just sorting through as many tweets as we could. And so we, you know, developed some software to automate a lot of this to see whenever someone tweeted and it looked like the tweet was about the presidential election and they were tweeting about a specific issue like immigration or gun control or abortion, we would try to find those tweets and in simplest terms, just count how often were people tweeting about one issue versus another, just as a way to get a gauge on where were people's collective attention. You know, what was the sort of share of voice? If you had 1 million people tweet in the last day about some issue, how many of those are about gun control versus abortion? And that was a way to just turn sort of this public fire hose of people tweeting into a kind of listening channel. And it kind of gave us a unique view into some of the issues that were on people's minds, and also when some event would happen, how did the attention, our kind of collective attention of what we were at least saying out loud on Twitter, how would it shift? And so, for example, when there was a kind of mass shooting event, I remember the conversation about gun control as an issue in the election suddenly jumped up. And then we could see within a couple of days, it would kind of fade back to where it was before. So you could also see the sort of ebb and flow of our collective attention, you know, in response to things. So those are examples of things we could do. And then we work with some newsrooms to just try to interpret some of that, those patterns and say, you know, how does that relate to what people are saying through other channels? You know, for example, when they do talk to a pollster and give their views in a private channel. And we did find that, you know, there were real differences in what people collectively were spending their time and attention on Twitter versus privately in the polls. And I think those are both valid windows into what's on people's minds. And I don't know how to sort them out and say one is more or less meaningful. They're both meaningful. Another thing we've looked at in our research, which is also worth mentioning, you know, one of them, a really important thing that happens on Twitter is people share links to news stories, to YouTube videos, and so forth. And that sharing function is really important. It means beyond kind of conventional broadcasters, whether you're running you have a television network or radio network or a podcast that has a big followership. Anyone who is on Twitter by retweeting can help spread a message. And so, you know, in a limited way, every user on Twitter is also a broadcaster. They can make their own decision of what's worth sharing and share it. So another piece of research we did was to look at how news, in particular, we zeroed in on news stories that were fact-checked by a number of well-known, incredible fact-checking organizations. And we asked the question, if you took all of the stories that had been fact-checked over a decade and look for how they were shared on Twitter. Could we find any patterns? In particular, since we knew from the fact checkers which stories the fact checkers thought were true versus false, we could divide up the stories into two buckets and see whether they spread differently. And we found that indeed there was striking differences where stories that turned out after fact-checking to be found to be false spread further, and they spread far faster than the stories that turned out by fact-checkers to be true. So that was, in some ways might just reinforce intuitions many of us have that the made-up stories that tend to be more provocative and kind of surprising are the ones that are more likely to spread. We found that in spades in this study. And so, along with everyone having the ability to become a kind of broadcaster of their own, there's certain emergent patterns sort of that as a collective we're helping propagate sometimes the stuff that maybe collectively we wish we weren't.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more. I want to talk a little bit more about that in a moment, but I do want to go back to kind of the public opinion piece of it just a little bit before we move on and ask you, you talked about some of the larger patterns that your research was able to find. I'm curious what you think about the efficacy of journalists and other people kind of using individual tweets when they're reporting on a story, almost as kind of a digital man on the street and just kind of, cherry picking mm-hmm. those and including them in news. Do you feel that that has an impact, or does that have can that distort things in any way in your mind?
Well, I think journalists that are using Twitter in that way, kind of to find individual reactions to things. There are still journalistic practices, right? Make sure you know who it is behind that tweet. And so check your sources and so forth. And if a journalist does that, I think that is just as valuable as calling up that person, getting a quote, and quoting them in a story. Now, it's important that the journalists know who it is that tweeted it. And on Twitter, you can have anonymous accounts that you can tweet as if you're someone else. And so it's important to check your sources and know who you're talking to. But yeah, I think it's a. In fact, I think Twitter, in that sense, is underutilized. Journalists often use Twitter as a place to get their message out, get their story out. But it's, I think, just as valuable as a way to tune in and listen to people.
So, which brings me to kind of what I wanted to talk about next, which is certainly you can look at Twitter being a place to kind of get a snapshot of public opinion, but it can also drive that public opinion and media coverage, right? And there is that opportunity for it to have this kind of almost like cyclical relationship, right? Where you can learn public opinion there, but then it can also start driving that public opinion on the back end.
Absolutely. Twitter, and I would generalize this, to other social media platforms. You're on Facebook or you're on TikTok, Instagram, et cetera, that it's both a place to learn about what's on the minds of others, but also to shape that, right? So it's a place where public opinion and public thought is being constructed and in ways that are absolutely new, right, for us as a species, right, because of the scale and the speed at which we're connected and have lines of sight to one another. So we're not just learning about public opinion. We're actually co-constructing it.
But that kind of opens the door, though, to some of the issues that Twitter and other social media platforms are dealing with now, which is how to deal with content that is either dis or misinformation, hate speech. We've seen that even just recently with the New York Post story on Hunter Biden. Can you tell us a little bit about kind of how Twitter is handling that piece of the puzzle and what are the issues that it faces in trying to kind of get a grip on that kind of content?
Yeah, it's first of all, I should just make clear, as a researcher, that, you know, our lab has a data agreement with Twitter, so we're able to analyze some of the patterns from our lab at MIT. But in terms of what's happening inside of Twitter and how they're making these decisions and so forth, just to be clear, I'm giving you an outsider's view.
Sure.
Kind of looking in now. I once had an insider's view where I had a role at Twitter, but that was years ago. Look, I think it's just enormously complex and situation where trying to be the arbiter of what is kind of high quality or reliable information, or to even decide to what degree that is the role of one of these platforms, these are all open questions because they were not part of the framing mission, as far as I know, of any of these platforms. But as their influence has grown, and what we just talked about, you know, a few minutes ago, just the collective attention, so everyone is now realizing how important these platforms have become, that these questions have arisen, and the landscape keeps changing. So it's a really, really hard and complex problem. And, you know, I think it's also interesting to realize that not all platforms are alike in terms of these issues. It's whenever people say to me, well, any social media platform, it just seems like it's a problem with social media. The kind of, you know, rampant spread of false, you know, misinformation and along with, you know, trolling and abuse, there's like a whole set of challenges. It's interesting to look at LinkedIn. You know, a few hundred million people. It's also a social network. And it's interesting how it's not that they don't have any problems at all, but some of these issues seem to be much less of a problem for that platform. And I think it's because there was a very clear and pretty narrow, in some ways, narrower sort of focus of what the platform was for, whereas some of these other platforms have been used for many different purposes by different groups of people. And so there may be less kind of conventions or norms or expectations across all the users of what is and is not the purpose of this platform. So that just makes the complexity of operating the platform that much harder. I don't know if I'm answering your question, Tom. Yeah. Maybe you can.
Well, I was going to say, let's maybe drill down a little bit. And I guess is there, you know, so obviously the thing, you know, people say is, well, they need to ban certain content or take down tweets or ban certain users. And I guess, you know, one of the issues that winds up happening with that is that if they do that, does it in some ways just kind of make things worse? If they ban people or content, is it possible they just wind up kind of pushing people more into their own bubbles where someone says, oh, you see, they banned it. This is clearly, you know, an effort to stifle, you know, my speech or a certain group's speech. I wonder if people kind of understand the nuance of you know, it becomes almost kind of whack-a-mole, right?
It does. And, you know, I think an interesting question is, you know, what is good or healthy or constructive communication, you know, or dialogue or media sharing, whatever it is? What does that mean? And can we agree? And who's the we? Is it everyone who chooses to use a platform has to agree, or should the platform be clear on what they value and put that out there as a kind of community agreement that, you know, here's what healthy exchanges look like. And there are now a lot of, you know, kind of experiments and sort of upstart new platforms or kind of spaces where there's a more deliberate attention, you know, on sort of like, here's the deal, right? Here's why we're here. Here's the kind of conversation we're having. Because otherwise, yeah, you end up with very different opinions on the basics. So someone might argue for diversity of opinions and perspectives as, you know, one of the things that's just like the bedrock for having a constructive or healthy space for, you know, for communication. And then someone might say, okay, I agree with that. And part of having diverse perspectives is to allow and support hate speech, right, or hateful speech. And someone else might say, well, no, that's not what I meant. By diverse, that's too diverse, right? And
right.
If it ends up being an attack on others, then that no longer is serving the overall purpose. So as long as we have those sorts of ambiguities where diversity means two very different things to different parties, and that is not clear up front, trying to retrofit a definition once you have hundreds of millions or, you know, in the case of Facebook, billions of users,
right,
and trying to kind of retrofit really the values and the kind of rules or the community agreement after the fact becomes a much more challenging kind of enterprise, right? And then on top of that, you are looking at platforms that are all global.
Right.
And so now they're intersecting with different cultural norms, but also different laws,
right? Right?
Legal systems in the different markets that they're operating in. So makes my head hurt just thinking about all the different challenges, right?
That
with
that ambiguity remaining, mm-hmm. What's your advice to people who are using Twitter about using it as a source of information? Are there some things that you would consider kind of best practices in your mind to make it a useful tool, get the most out of it, without, you know, going down rabbit holes of, you know, that easily you can?
Yeah, you know, I guess my own approach has been I have an overall purpose in what I use Twitter for. So I use it primarily to keep up with news, and, you know, I'm a political news junkie, and I am pretty deliberate on, you know, who I follow. I try to follow a pretty wide range of voices, including people I don't agree with. I'm slow on the retweet. So, you know, one of the things that just because of, you know, research I've personally been involved with, the immediate, when you feel yourself just wanting in the moment compelled to share something, to think twice before you share, to make sure this is something that you think should be shared. You know, just paying careful attention to sources of when you're seeing something, it sometimes is easy to just be in your timeline and just see all the text scrolling by and sort of lose track of sources of where different pieces of, you know, your feed are coming from, to just be thoughtful of where it's coming from. And yeah, those are some of the things that I try to keep in mind when I'm on Twitter.
Well, building on that, we usually end this podcast by asking each of our guests, you know, where do you get your news on a daily basis? What are your kind of go-to news sources? I know you talked about having kind of a diverse set of news sources. Can you give us maybe a little bit of a picture into what they are and what you kind of use to give yourself a full picture?
Sure. My strategy is if I look at my web browser right now, I have a set of news sources, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, CNN, Fox News, Politico, Breitbart, Globe and Mail, Atlantic Monthly, BBC, Japan Times, Le Monde. So there's a handful of the kind of mainstream American sources that I'm probably you know, touching once or twice a day. And then every now and then, you know, I'm, as a Canadian citizen, I'm curious what the Globe and Mail has to say, and every now and then I'll just kind of take a step back and look at whether the BBC or Japan Times, and just curious where the global attention is, at least from those other vantage points. So kind of those are some of the news sources that I'll pretty regularly zoom into.
Dr. Deb Roy, Professor of Media Arts and Sciences at MIT, Director of the Lab for Social Machines and Executive Director of the MIT Media Lab. We really do appreciate taking some time and joining us on the A Matter of Facts podcast.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to the latest edition of the A Matter of Facts podcast. The full podcast is available at DelawarePublic.org and DEHumanities.org. A Matter of Facts is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Its mission is to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. We thank the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation for its generous support of this initiative and the Pulitzer Prizes for its partnership. A Matter of Facts is produced by Delaware Public Media. And that's all we have time for on this special edition of The Green. The stories and podcasts you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Mark Fowler, Sierra Fisher, and Kyle Parks with Delaware Humanities, and Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again this Friday on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.